This week on Your Western Context, Trudeau's government spends millions fighting veterans in court. A panel calls for more Canadian content on streaming services, and stigma surrounds the coronavirus outbreak in Canada. Also, Trudeau gives $50 million to MasterCard amid a household debt crisis. This is Western Context, episode 154, recorded Friday, January 31st, 2020, Stigma and Defamation. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context as we head into our fourth year here of doing the podcast. This week is a bit of a different Western Context episode as we're foregoing our regular Alberta and BC specials, focusing entirely on Canada. But that, of course, doesn't deflate any of the news that we got this week.
Yeah, that's for sure. We've got quite a bit of news this week and a lot that the media has talked about and a lot that they haven't talked about, and certainly some that social media has been spreading misinformation about as well. So we've got the full stories on those and coming up more to really try and demystify the fog that has settled over the country in the last week.
And if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is a podcast that aims to cut through all the media bias and sensationalism that you find in the mainstream news and ever more so online in their publications. And in doing so, we hope to provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And if you want full show notes, you can follow along at westerncontext.ca. And we're going to start off with one of our stories involving a federal cabinet minister.
Yes, this one is something that came about as a result of questions being asked in the House of Commons. And it was found out this week that one of Trudeau's closest friends and most visible cabinet ministers, Seamus O'Regan, who is the former Minister of Veterans Affairs and is now the Minister of Natural Resources, he spent over $180,000 of taxpayers' money fighting a veteran in court. Now, the amount was found out after the Conservative Party's Veteran Affairs critic Phil McColeman had submitted a written request in the House of Commons to determine how much the government has spent on the case involving veterans advocate Sean Broya and Seamus O'Regan, and he called it an outrageous amount. Now, Broya is seeking $25,000 in compensation for damage he says was done to his reputation in a 2018 column written by Mr. O'Regan when he held the veterans portfolio, and that column was published in the Hill Times, which is an Ottawa-based newspaper that covers Parliament. Now, the minister's 2018 column followed an article by Broya in the same newspaper in which he wrote the changes to the pension system for disabled armed forces staff would pay some veterans who apply for benefits after March 2019 less than the previous system. Now, O'Regan then accused the veteran of stating mistruths and suggested that he made numerous other errors, which prompted Broya to sue for defamation. And he said that O'Regan's personal attacks forced him into the court to defend his honor and reputation, along with defending the rights of all Canadians to speak freely. He said, quote, "Government claims it honors veterans and then bullies and intimidates them through expensive and vindictive court motions. I fought in uniform and paid a heavy price to defend our constitutional rights. Now I have to defend my dignity against the very government I sacrificed to protect, merely for exercising our right to freedom of expression." Now, Broya's Ottawa-based lawyer, Paul Champ, said that one of the most outrageous things about litigating against the federal government is that it always prepares to fight vigorously, regardless of whether it has a strong case or the value of the case. Champ said that, quote, "Mr. O'Regan did have some pretty blunt critical remarks about Mr. Broya that he put in a newspaper. Does it rise to the level of defamation? We think it does, but they should understand that there's definitely a risk there. So why would they spend almost $200,000 on a case that they should know that there's a good chance they may lose?" Now, Phil McColeman agrees that the government and Ronald Reagan could have conducted themselves differently, adding that the minister shouldn't have, quote, forced a veteran to have him take him to court over his comments. He said the matter could have been resolved without legal costs far greater than the compensation being sought. He said, adding that a, quote, simple apology would have been nice. Now, the Broye debacle is not the only court case that the Liberals have incurred outrageous cost to fight because of their own incompetence. The federal government has rang up more than $1.4 million in legal costs during the failed prosecution of now-retired Vice Admiral Mark Norman. Justice Minister David Lametti, when he was prompted for the legal cost figures, which he was then forced to give, also did not respond to questions about how much the RCMP spent on the original investigation into allegations that Norman had leaked cabinet secrets about a $700 million federal shipbuilding contract. Now, that investigation prompted Chief of the Defense Staff General Jonathan Vance to suspend Norman as the military second-in-command in January of 2017, and the popular vice admiral was then charged with breach of trust in March 2018. Now, the Mounties and Crown prosecutors alleged that Norman had leaked information about the contract to pressure the new Liberal government in 2015 to move ahead with the project to convert a civilian ship into a temporary support vessel for the Navy rather than cancel it. Now, Norman pled not guilty before his lawyer spent months in court fighting the Crown and government for access to thousands of documents that they said were essential for ensuring their client received a fair trial. And throughout the process, Norman's lawyers alleged the case against their client was politically motivated and that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his government were interfering in it, which is a charge that was picked up by the Conservatives and that the Liberals denied. Now, Crown prosecutors eventually stayed the charge back in May 2019, which we covered on the show, telling the judge that new evidence they'd received from Norman's defense team had led them to conclude that there was no reasonable chance of a conviction. Now, following the failed prosecution, Norman asserted that he wanted to return to duty, but he and the government instead reached a financial settlement, the details of which had not been made public before the vice admiral retired last year. So, in the end, it was just $1.4 million on legal fees, but in the end, it could have been much more based on the financial settlement, what the persecution took in the first place, the investigation by the RCMP. It could have been anywhere up to the millions, and we don't know exactly how much it could be, only that it was all for nothing. Now, when the Liberal government claims that they've improved veterans' affairs and support the military, and on the other hand, pay high-priced Bay Street lawyers millions of dollars to fight veterans in court just to defend their own mistakes, there's definitely some cognitive dissonance there. And thankfully, with just a minority government in Parliament, Trudeau will have a harder time keeping his government skeletons buried.
And, you know, when we look at these kind of stories that involve the military, it's always a wonder how they can remain hidden for so long, because, you know, there's a good old-fashioned saying in government and politics that there's two people, two groups, and probably more, but definitely two that you don't take money from. You definitely don't take money from seniors, and you definitely don't take money from the military and military veterans. And that's, of course, what's happening in this case. We've seen time and time again countless steps in the previous Trudeau majority Liberal government where the government has failed to defend veterans, provide the adequate gear and services that the military needs to operate. And this just seems to be effectively steady as she goes in that regard, keeping the military at arm's length. And when the veterans say something or they want to do something that is deemed a bit controversial that the government doesn't want to do, or they put them in this kind of position, they take them to court. And, you know, you really have to ask the question, what other developed nation in the 21st century takes its veterans to court when they disagree with them? And if you look at that list and you see Canada on there and you compare who Canada's with and you look at these countries, it's probably not a good light for Canada in that regard.
Yeah, that's for sure. And just the fact that they've spent millions of dollars fighting these cases when they know they aren't going to win, when easily they could have settled outside of court for a lesser amount, and they could have, made the apology based on what was actually there. And instead, when you compare that to something like the Omar Khadr case, where they did settle out of court because they said they didn't want to fight a legal battle there, and they ended up giving Omar Khadr $10.5 million in the settlement that they came up with, it's definitely odd how they take the veterans to court, and yet someone like Omar Khadr gets the settlement and gets to avoid having to go to trial. And it's definitely very odd how that's the liberals are prioritizing their court cases.
And that's just the state of affairs of this government in 2020. You know, many people were hopeful that with the election and taking down the liberals to a minority from a majority, that it might inject some humble sauce into that of the cabinet and government. And, you know, we're seeing here that for all intents and purposes, it's carrying on exactly as it was. So we're going to see more of that in our other stories this week here on Western Context. But before we do that, I'll just take a moment and remind all our listeners of our Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/Western Context. And there we offer three tiers of support if you want to support the podcast monetarily. For $2 a month, the price of a cup of coffee, you can help us remove media bias and sensationalism from the news. And for the price of a sandwich, $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that. And you can also have your name read out on the podcast if you want. For $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. And in case you're wondering what's going to be done with this, when we reach $25 a month in contributions, we'll craft two Patreon-exclusive articles for our Patreon supporters to read, and these will expand on the coverage of our show stories from the month, and they'll continue to provide the context and information that you've come to expect from us. At $50 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast, effectively an extra podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs may be headed next. Finally, if you want to just make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, you can do that as well. Just visit westerncontext.ca to learn more about the PayPal option and the Patreon option as well. Thank you for your support. All right, so as I mentioned, we are, of course, this week focusing exclusively on Canada, and this week, independent panel report into the Canadian media landscape and the Canadian telecom landscape was released. And if you look at the headlines from Global CTV and in particular the CBC, the headlines all say that the report calls for more Canadian streaming content and an ad-free CBC. Yeah, an ad-free CBC. And we'll get into just what exactly that means in a moment. But first, we need to look at the fact that this independent panel report actually called for the CBC to stop selling ads and for Canadians to have access to more Canadian content on streaming services, which on the surface people might not have a problem with, but the devil is in the details, as they say. First off, the independent panel was a panel that was set up by the Liberal Party, so naturally it's going to reflect the government of the day's opinions. The media reporting on this report was shoddy at best, since key points were missed, and in favor of other topics that were discussed, the media just decided to focus on their own interests, what the media landscape was going to look like. Because, as we often talk about here at Western Context, it seems as though that most of the stories that the media publishes, whether it be on the TV news or on their websites or social media platforms, is designed to garner links and clicks and shares around the internet, rather than providing the actual content that people come to expect and really could see back before the turn of the century, even going further into the 1960s, looking at classic American evening news broadcasts as an example. Now, with this, we, of course, have the independent panel, but we also have streaming services and the tax associated around them. Everybody likes their own version of streaming services, whether it be Apple TV+, Disney+, or Netflix, one of the originals. And what the panel report calls for is for streaming services, or media curators, as it's called in the report, for them to invest in Canadian programming. So this means that Netflix, Apple TV Plus, and Disney Plus would all need to have some form of Canadian programming, or at least some flavor of Canadian programming available, maybe a specific section dedicated to Canadian originals. Now, the report made itself clear that it's not suggesting a Netflix tax that was suggested in 2015 by the Liberal Party, but one thing the report did suggest was that these streaming services like Netflix or Apple TV Plus should have the GST or HST applied to them if they are a foreign service. So what this means is that Netflix, Apple, Amazon Prime Video, or any other foreign streaming service would effectively need to devote a portion of their budget to Canadian-made programs and highlighting those on the service. And that's exactly what the tax, or rather adding the GST on top of it, would do, is it would effectively send more money to the government, and then the government would mandate that Netflix or Amazon Prime Video has to have this Canadian content. Now, the panel calls on themselves to consider the implementation or the implications of this when you think about it. When you have a huge panel report and it calls on themselves to examine something, you really have to wonder what exactly is turning around in the heads, because you're not going to get a fair analysis of the impact of this if it is you who suggested it. Now, putting two and two together, this could mean that service costs could go up if the companies are forced to provide Canadian programming. And as it stands right now, for a full HD subscription to Netflix, that's $14.99 a month. And I don't know that many Canadians would want to pay more than that. Now, of course, what everybody was talking about this in this story was the CBC, the third point. Now, the report says that the CBC should stop selling ads and become a fully funded public network, something that would be similar to NPR in the United States, which stands for National Public Radio. They don't take extra funding, and they're funded by government grants. Now, for anybody who's been listening to this podcast for a while, you'll remember our various segments on the programming at the CBC, in particular from Rosemary Barden, her performance at the federal election debate, who is now a CBC's chief political correspondent after being removed from the National. And this is exactly what we're seeing, is we're seeing that the government would be funding the exact activities of the CBC exclusively that we've been talking about since the very beginning here of Western Context. What this report is effectively calling for the CBC to become a true state broadcaster, in that it would be entirely public funded. And when you look at some of the reporting that happens at the CBC, you can see that it definitely leans in the favor of the government. Right now, with the CBC's current slate of programming and their opinion analysis, having that be publicly funded, it should make every Canadian worry. The CBC is losing money now without a major shakeup, which of course can be read as not more government money and forcing it to innovate heavily. It will continue to just suck in more taxpayer money, and Canadians aren't going to get good value from it. Most media reporting on this missed other huge issues and focused primarily on the streaming side and the CBC side of the equation, while suggestions for mobile telecom operators were largely glossed over. Now, there was also some good outlining done by Shadow Minister for Industry and Economic Development Michelle Rempel and Shadow Minister for Heritage Stephen Blaney, but what they wound up doing is they went over many of the other huge areas that were left behind in the mainstream media reporting on this. The Conservatives took a stance on privacy to ensure that there is a legal means to protect the data dignity, as they call it, of all Canadians. What they want with this is they want to ensure that every bit of data that's generated when you go online is guarded safely. The European Union does this with their privacy laws, known as GDPR, and this should have been top news that the opposition Conservatives, were effectively calling for steeper privacy legislation, something that might look like what the EU has. The Conservatives also want fewer regulations that prevent the construction of new broadband infrastructure, especially in rural Canada. Now, of course, we get to the big elephant in the room, a decision that the government will likely need to make this year, and that comes to Huawei and 5G technology. We talked about at various points in the last year Huawei and the Huawei CFO that is being held in Vancouver, Meng Wanzhou. But as Michelle Rempel points out, 5G will create multiple entry points for bad actors to access data and even disrupt networks. This means that any company that provides 5G technology to the networks in Canada would ultimately have this capability. And we mentioned this briefly on the podcast last week when talking about the fake Mengwanzhou protests. Rogers is looking at using technology from Ericsson, while TELUS and Bell are looking at using the 5G technology from Huawei. Rempel calls on the government to ensure that the civilians' data will be secure from 5G operators, and this is ever so more important as 5G devices become ubiquitous in Canada. The conservative response also calls for the democratization of choice and access to Canadian content funding, meaning that Canadians should have a say through technology in what services or outlets get the funding, and that the government should not employ a top-down approach, effectively choosing the winners and losers. Finally, the conservatives highlight the importance to protect free speech on the internet and social media. Stephen Guilbeau, the heritage minister who would ultimately be in charge of these changes to the broadcasting landscape, has also been asked to look for ways to combat hate speech online when he received his mandate letter when he became the minister. So that's something else that the conservatives have addressed in their response that was largely glossed over by the media. So from everything from the panel composition to the media's focus on themselves to the complete lack of mentioning Huawei and all this, the media needs to put people first instead of themselves. And after all, it was only last week that we covered the fake Huawei protests, and here we are. The government is moving closer to making a decision on Huawei and completely changing the way the media landscape works in Canada, and the media is out to lunch talking about themselves, streaming in the CBC.
Yeah, and I think one just has to look more at the CBC slate of programming just to see exactly how much Canadian content they're actually pushing. If you actually look at their lineup from between 1 p.m. and 10 p.m., we see things such as Escape to the Chateau, DIY, Vet on the Hill, the Great British Baking Show, and of course, the great British soap opera known as Coronation Street, and all these are British shows, and that's an entire slate from between 3 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. that are not Canadian. And for people wanting Canadians to have more content on the CBC, you have to ask yourselves what exactly is going to go in those spots. Is it going to be old shows that CBC has produced in the past, or what else are they going to put in there? Because they do have Canadian shows on there, but quite honestly, there's not really much of a market out there because, as it stands, Canadians either just watch CBC for hockey or they do it for news such as the National or any other power and politics programs. But, you know, it just comes down to what Canadians are actually wanting to watch. And more, they're watching more American networks. And it comes down to whether something like this would be a good thing for the CBC to actually make any revenue. Because to be fair, the CBC has been losing lots and lots of viewers over the last few years, and quite clearly they need to do something to stay afloat. But I don't know if more government funding is the answer for this, because I think something else needs to change instead.
Yeah, and that's what it comes down to entirely. The panel is asking itself to look into the implications on it, and that's the circular logic that they're going to employ on that. But we can take it up one step further and say that the government appointed this panel, and anything that the panel suggests will, of course, be friendly to the Liberal government in most cases, unless there are things, of course, that aren't of consequence, because I don't think there's a situation in the world where we could imagine the current administration wanting to pull funding away from the CBC, because that's not going to happen, as it seems. So,
yeah, and in fact, they're wanting to increase funding to the CBC. So one will have to ask themselves if the funding for CBC is worth it, given their focus on non-Canadian content, and if the Canadian content is something that they actually want to see on the CBC, because more focus on that tends to lead to a drop in viewership. So it comes down to what the Canadians want, and if you want the CBC to run profitably and more like a business, then it needs to stop going with what the government is saying on this issue.
Indeed. And with that, I think we can move on to our next story, which is, of course, what everybody is talking about as the top stories this week, and that's the coronavirus making its way over to Canada.
Yeah, that's for sure. On last week's episode, when we were talking about Meng Wanzhou's extradition hearing and the fake protests outside of the courthouse, I could have also mentioned another problem that has exited China in the last few weeks, and that being the respiratory disease known as novel coronavirus, more colloquially known as coronavirus. Now, the coronavirus outbreak is believed to have originated from the Huanan Seafood Wholesale Market in Wuhan, which is one of China's largest cities. Now, although Huanan Market is known as a seafood market, it was primarily known for the sale of bushmeat and other exotic animals due to the demand for such animals for consumption. Now, the South China Morning Post reported on the 29th of January that the market had a section selling about 120 wildlife animals across 75 different species, including such strange choices for consumption, such as badgers, bats, camel, crocodile, dogs, foxes, salamanders, otters, porcupines, rats, turtles, snakes, and wolf puppies. So, because of this, the coronavirus strain is believed to have come from animals originally, though given the nature of the market, it's hard to know for sure which species. In a pursuit to discover the origin, samples from the market's animals were taken between January 1st and January 12th, and later on, this Chinese Center for Disease Control and Prevention revealed that the virus was found in 33 out of 585 of those animal specimens, 31 of which came from the area of the market where the wildlife was particularly found. Now, as the coronavirus spread further, people started dying from it in China as it spread to every Chinese province and into other countries as well. Now, at 2 a.m. on January 23rd, Wuhan authorities issued a notice informing residents of Wuhan that from 10 a.m. that day, all public transport, including buses, railways, flights, and ferry services, would be suspended. And the notice caused an exodus from Wuhan. An estimated 300,000 people were reported to have left Wuhan by train alone before the 10 a.m. lockdown. By the afternoon, the authorities began shutting down some of the major highways leaving Wuhan, but it's unknown how many people actually left Wuhan in total before the lockdown took place. Now, the lockdown came 2 days before the Chinese New Year, which is the most important festival in the country, and traditionally it's part of the peak traveling season when millions of Chinese people travel across the country, which has exacerbated the spread of the disease. Now, the first confirmed case of coronavirus in Canada was announced on January 25th, and currently there are 4 cases in Canada that authorities know about. One of them is in Vancouver, and the other 3 are located in Toronto, one of the 3 being the wife of one of them, the very first confirmed case. Now, all cases are either people who have returned to Canada in the past few weeks or are family members of those infected. Ontario Health Minister Christine Elliott said that Ontario's public health system has shown remarkable responsiveness to the new virus. She said, as we learn more about the 2019 novel coronavirus, related tools and procedures are getting more precise and more effective. Every Ontarian should have full confidence that these efforts by our dedicated public health professionals are keeping them safe. Because of their hard work, the risk to Ontarians remains low. Now, despite testing samples from 114 suspected cases in BC, the BC government said on Friday that there is just still the 1 confirmed case of the Wuhan coronavirus in the province, which was known as the 3rd in the country. And that confirmed case in the Vancouver Coastal Health Region is a man in his 40s who traveled to Wuhan, the center of the disease. He is said to be recovering at home. Dr. Bonnie Henry, who is the BC's provincial health officer, said that health officials are at a critical phase in the response to the coronavirus after China took restrictive measures to try to control the outbreak. She said that will help us protect us as well as protect other parts of China. Those measures that were taken really about 10 days ago, and we are now at the point where people have traveled here to BC and to Canada who are incubating this disease may start showing symptoms. Now, social media panic and media misinformation has led to a number of bizarre responses to the outbreak. Recently pictured was a woman and her child wearing face masks and water jugs over their heads at YVR Airport in Vancouver. We've actually got an example of that as our picture of the week this week. It should also be known that airlines such as Air Canada and WestJet have canceled flights to China, but have not canceled flights from China, which has been adding to the headlines and perceived fear. And it's pretty much guessed that the canceled flights to China were because there's not much of a demand for that as the fears of coronavirus have spread further. Now, Canada's chief health officer has also cautioned the public about, quote, racism against Chinese Canadians, saying, quote, I am concerned about the growing number of reports of racism and stigmatizing comments on social media directed to people of Chinese and Asian descent related to the coronavirus outbreak. This was from Dr. Teresa Tam, who wrote on Twitter on Wednesday night. Now, Chinese-Canadian businesses are suffering as well. Tawny Louie, who is the chair of Toronto's Chinatown Business Improvement Association, said on Thursday that he was seeing far more empty parking spots in the area than normal. Now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention does not advise wearing containers on your head to prevent a coronavirus infection. While there are no current vaccines available to protect you against coronavirus infection, the CDC does advise that you may be able to reduce your risk of infection by doing the following. Washing your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, or mouth with unwashed hands. And to avoid close contact with people sick. And as long as we do that, we can start to curb the outbreak as well as having further responses from the government whenever a case props up.
And you know, when you boil it down to that, that's pretty much the same advice that's given with every flu season, to protect yourself from other folks who are sick. And you know, this virus, for the most part, has infected more people than SARS did in 2003, but thankfully, it is a lot less lethal than SARS proved to be, which I think everybody is breathing a huge sigh of relief for right now, though that doesn't preclude the possibility that the virus could change or mutate in the future to become more virulent. So that's, of course, what all the public health officials are going to be watching for at this time. But you know, we have two very large hub airports in Canada, Toronto and Vancouver. Air Canada and WestJet made good decisions in blocking those flights, but perhaps they should have taken an approach that British Airways did, where they actually stopped all flights to and from mainland China because of this viral outbreak. And you know, when we're looking at it from this perspective, I don't think it's fair to say that this is racism against Chinese Canadians. If the flights are being shut down, it is for a reason of public health. And it's not because people are suddenly becoming racist against Chinese people. Vancouver has one of the largest Chinese populations in Canada, and they are very successful and very prosperous. And the idea of curtailing the flights to and from China could be seen in a light to preserve that prosperity and keep Canadians safe in that regard. So it's certainly not racist to begin thinking about slowing flights or stopping flights entirely from China.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the chief health officer coming out about this was talking more so about comments on social media, which, as we all know, should not be taken as gospel, because social media can get into a panic. All you have to do is follow a sports team and see the social media impacts after a win versus after a loss, just to see the very difference in swaying opinions that people can have online. And I think it is very real that a lot of Chinese and Asian businesses in general have been impacted by this, but certainly with something like this, you don't want to mess about, and you want to make sure that you have a very preventative approach to something like this that could mutate into something much worse. I think after a full month of this thing growing, we only have the 4 cases in Canada. Certainly, there's a lot more than that that actually has the flu right now, which is much more able to spread from people to people. So I think as long as people practice good hygiene, and if they are coming into the country, they don't actually keep quiet about their ailments, I think that would help to stop the spread as well.
All right. And with that, we'll, of course, keep watching this and make sure that nothing else crazy in the media happens regarding coronavirus. But if they do, we'll, of course, provide updates as needed. And we're going to move on to our firing line segment right now. And it was very hard to choose a firing line this week because there were definitely a few that could fit into that category. And of course, the firing line is a section of our show where we talk about a story that has been entirely missed by the media or is just covered in the entirely wrong way. And this one was definitely missed in the media. At least its details were. So there's a good piece in the Toronto Sun by Brian Lilly that says, Trudeau hands MasterCard a gift of your money. And, you know, you might be wondering what this is about. It garnered a few minutes on the news on Global and CTV, nothing on CBC from what I can tell. But last week, MasterCard announced a new $500 million cybersecurity center in Vancouver, and this project will receive $49 million in funding from the federal government. Okay, so that's one side of it, and that's the way the Conservatives were looking at it, in particular opposition leader Andrew Scheer, but we'll get to that in a bit. Now, the Global Intelligence and Cyber Center will, as they say, accelerate innovation in digital and cybersecurity, artificial intelligence, and the Internet of Things. Now, CTV and Global ran with this story last week, making passing mention of the almost $50 million given by the federal government. Now, recall that last year in one of our worst government expense stories on our year roundup episode, we highlighted the government's $12 million for Loblaws to buy new energy efficient refrigerators when the company itself is worth billions. Thankfully, this week, the government was asked about the MasterCard case in question period by opposition leader Andrew Scheer. He said, why did the Prime Minister make taxpayers so sad by giving $50 million to a company that made $16 billion last year off the backs of hard-working Canadians who can't afford to pay their full balances? Now, as happens in the House of Commons, the exchange went back and forth between the Prime Minister, and he went to his standard fallback of growing the middle class. The NDP even took issue with this when Jagmeet Singh stood up and asked why the money wasn't being invested into Canadian healthcare, for example, but instead being given to a profitable global company instead. MasterCard is, of course, known for their priceless ad campaign, and this is where the Conservative leader went next. He said, having a wasteful government that believes in corporate welfare isn't priceless. Turns out it's worth $50 million. So now, here at Western Context, we have to ask, what's next? And why is this on the show? Well, as it is, $50 million to a very profitable credit card company is a story, and we would be talking about that. That would fit into the category of being one of the worst expenses when we do our year-end roundup at the end of the year. So if we ended this story right now, we would be perfectly content in calling this a firing line here at Western Context. But it kept getting better. Or, as it is for taxpayers, worse. So, as was revealed by the Postmillennial in online publication just yesterday, it turns out that MasterCard lobbyist Jennifer M. Sloan worked as the Liberal-appointed chief of staff and chief of media relations for 2 cabinet ministers under the Jean Chrétien government. The Postmillennial also used the National Follow the Money database, which is a database that's set up by Post Media that tracks donations. And with this, they saw that the same Jennifer M. Sloan, who contributed $1,500 to the Liberals in 2016, also had a history of other donations to the party. In fact, there were 18 donations that were made by just Jennifer Sloan, without the M, that were totaling $11,675 going back to 2016. So with that, $1,500 in one and more totaling up to $11,675. Now, when asked about this, calls, messages, and emails to both the Liberals and MasterCard went unanswered. Money and politics should ultimately be transparent. The population deserves to know where their public officials are getting their money to campaign on, where the parties are getting their money to campaign on. And there were pieces of legislation that were brought in back in 2006 to limit the amount of money that people could donate, to limit the amount of influence that corporations and unions could have. But here we see that lobbying is still actually going on, because when you connect the dots, this Jennifer M. Sloan is currently working for MasterCard. The person made donations to the Liberal Party, and lo and behold, MasterCard gets this $50 million cash infusion to build, or rather work on as part of their building in Vancouver, which when you think about it, you add two and two together, you get four. And it certainly looks like in this case that Jennifer M. Sloan, or at least MasterCard, successfully lobbied the Liberal government to get more money, and in doing so, they give $11,000, and in turn get about $50 million back. Lobbying's not new, but ultimately when a person donates thousands and thousands of dollars to a party, and it's found by an online publication, the Postmillennial, using a post-media database that everybody in the media has access to, you have to ask where the media exactly was on this story this week, because one, $50 million going towards MasterCard is not a small amount of money that the federal government gives out. Two, somebody donating to the Liberal Party and yet also being entwined with MasterCard is a huge deal as well. And three, the same person donating $11,675 to the Liberals really puts the cherry on top, and the media should have been asking a lot more questions this week about this, but they weren't.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that they were giving $50 million to MasterCard, a company which, as Andrew Scheer did say, has been making money off the backs of people who can't afford to pay their balances off. And it's very tone deaf, given that we just had another report saying that the household debt for Canadians is rising even further. And that household debt can contribute to a even worse recession should it hit. And the economists have been saying now that recession could hit any time over the next few years, and that government spending and putting the Liberal government's penchant for putting Canadians further into debt could cause a problem with this. And the fact that Canadians themselves don't have much of a problem with that the Canadian households do have such a huge problem with paying off their credit and their household debt is increasing further and further, it could cause even more problems should a recession hit. So the government, colluding with MasterCard, which is one of the biggest credit card companies in the world, to give them more of taxpayers' money just to open up a center in Vancouver, it's very tone deaf. And I think the media could have picked up on that a lot more in the past week.
And they didn't. And, you know, credit goes to both Andrew Scheer and Jagmeet Singh for hammering this in the House of Commons. People don't seem to watch the House of Commons unless there's an election or an impeachment or something akin to a government falling happening. And they should be, because this was there. And if you do a little bit of digging, as the Postmillennial did, in a database that's available to everybody, you could have had this huge revelation, and Canadians need to know about this, but it wasn't there. And, you know, this, I think, goes nicely into our word of the week, in particular for the media, MasterCard, and, of course, the China case as well.
And even just going back further to Seamus O'Regan and Justin Trudeau himself. And that is why our word of the week this week is stigma, which is defined as a mark of disgrace associated with a particular circumstance, quality, or person. And certainly the mark of disgrace has been thrust upon China for the coronavirus outbreak, but certainly I think there's been a lot of unfair stigma placed on Chinese Canadians that have been unduly affected by the coronavirus outbreak. But certainly there's been a lot of stigma attached to the Canadian government, especially Justin Trudeau and Seamus O'Regan, especially when it comes to the court cases that they're fighting with taxpayer money. And certainly a lot of stigma there coming with the CBC and Canadian programming and our big telecoms companies that are trying to make a deal with Huawei. And I think that just goes to show why stigma is this week's word of the week.
Yeah, it really sums everything nicely together, ties it in, has a bit of a piercing into each of the stories, and that's what we look for in a good word of the week. And if you want to read any of the source material on that, as we mentioned, you can find that in the full show notes at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the show on any number of podcast listeners out there, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Casts, anything under the sun. Visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe for the entire list. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we share all the stories that we're looking at throughout the entire week and sometimes a little bit of extra news. So be sure to give us a follow there, Twitter and Facebook at Western Context. With that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always make sure to look through all the stories that the media talks about and some that they don't talk about, just so we can uncover the true news of what's been going on in the week and to make sure that you have the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.